Tuesday, June 8th, was an overwhelmingly full day. In the morning, desk work in beauty parlor. Returning just in time to encounter National Society of Interior Decorators, some 350, who were having a tour of the White House, with Mr. Ketchum standing in for me. I rushed right into their midst as I came in from Jean-Louise, flying through the diplomatic room, and was soon engulfed in saying hello on every hand. I found myself standing in front of the fireplace, receiving their tribute, which Jim Ketchum was going to receive in my place. A brief encounter, and then on upstairs from meeting with Liz, Bess, Barbara Keene, and Dr. Eric Goldman in the Queen's Room over a bite of lunch to talk about my bete noire, the Festival of Arts, next Monday, June 14th. I was a little, not much, reassured by all they told me. This I know, a great deal of work has gone into it, most of it done by Dr. Goldman, most of it good work, but the Lowell affair has gotten us off to a bad start. And then, with the quick changes, the shifts of gears of the mind that go with this life, down to the West Hall, talked to Bob Gitwillig about Mrs. Johnson's book. I'd seen the mock-up. It looks wonderful. He wants me to do a story for some magazine about my trips around the country to county courthouses and old graveyards in Virginia and Maryland with Mrs. Johnson. In general, about her interest in genealogy and how it developed. It was relaxing to find something that sounded like it was going well. The next session with Simone and John Secondary about the ABC documentary on the beautification of Washington. This too, like the Festival of the Arts, looms as a great question mark, though I found since starting it that I'm much more at ease than I'd thought, that I actually enjoy parts. It's just that we must establish the line of communication between us and that lady on the other end of the set in the living room in Gadsden, Alabama, and Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and make them think, now what can I go out and do? That line of communication I have not seen come through yet. And then to the big event of the day at 6 o'clock, to the East Room for the reception for the Presidential Scholars. There they were, all seated in their gilt chairs, 120 of them, 60 girls and 60 boys. There was one more, but he was absent. Two from each state of the Union, some from territories, and some at large. As the paper said, not even a sardine could have squeezed into the East Room of the White House. Beside the students, there were their parents, of course, and distinguished guests from all walks of life that we had invited to add to the luster of the occasion, to inspire the young folks, and to send them home thinking they'd seen something of their wonderful country. TV and all its machines and humans takes up so much room that many distinguished guests, John Glenn, the astronaut, Robert Merrill, the opera singer, lots of parents and aides and press were standing, pressed together against the walls. I went in ahead. I took a seat in the front row, and Lyndon came in a little bit late for the tune of Hail to the Chief. Lyndon warmed up the audience by saying, "We are delighted to greet the parents of the scholars this afternoon. Having gone through the experience of graduating our second daughter last week, Mrs. Johnson and I feel it might be in order to give parents medals, too." And then the line I liked best in the speech, "An abiding faith in man himself, and a decent respect for yourself and your own potential." He recognized a certain rising discord in the world of the intellectuals when he said, "Another value I regard as very nearly supreme is that of believing that every man created in the image of God has something to say to his time, and has the right to be heard by his contemporaries without prejudice or without misconception." At the end of his speech, after the rising and the clapping, he smiled and walked out. And this is an example that not even at the White House does everything go in clockwork, for every affair must be, in a measure, rehearsed beforehand. He and I and all who really participate in it should know, should be told, exactly what we do, when. It is a matter of precision and grace combined. The indispensable Bess, who always does that so quietly, so efficiently, for once somehow had not done it. I didn't really know what Lennon was supposed to do. I should have quickly observed the white-wrapped, gold-ribboned boxes behind him. Those were the medals on the table. I didn't. He walked out. I went out to find out what the score was. Bess came swiftly and told us that instead of standing in line in the blue room to receive them, students and all, it would really be much simpler if he returned to the podium, greeted the students there, and as each name was called out, handed him or her the Presidential Medal. And so, feeling very awkward, back in we went. Names were called, the students filed past. Lyndon shook hands. I knew by his smile he was trying to invest each one with that feeling of, this is a big moment that he or she deserved. I knew also that he was feeling ruffled, as I was, by the confusion. And then a blind girl, Susan Maltby from Oregon, was led up onto the stage by a White House aide. And although he was trying to be very solicitous, he should have practically lifted her down from the platform as she returned, for she stumbled. Fortunately, he caught her gracefully enough so she wasn't embarrassed. I jumped up, motioned to them to take my seat at the front, otherwise she would have had to go once more through the crowd to a seat somewhere in the rear. Another snafu, the aide didn't understand, and of course the blind girl didn't. But presently, some helpful person brought her back, put her down in the seat I'd vacated, and another gentleman rose and insisted that I sit by her. These are the sort of things you have to smile through. When each one had received his medal, Lyndon and I went once more to the blue room, and there we met the parents of all the youngsters, proud and smiling, just as Lyndon and I had been. Linda Byrd, in her freshman year at the University of Texas, had made the Honor Society. Nothing could have kept me away. And along with the parents, distinguished guests, there was quaint little poetess Marianne Moore, fragile and old, John O'Hara, an author, Dr. Jonas Salk, who gave the world the vaccine against polio, and Stan Musial, the great figure in baseball, now special consultant to Lyndon on physical fitness. And I had a hug for the Bill Hagerty's of Drexel University, now lost to us at the University of Texas. And pretty Dr. Jean Noble, who'd worked with the Girls' Job Corps, was there. Barbara Tuckman, author of Guns of August. Jason Robards, whose performance in Arthur Miller's rather ill-fated play I'll never forget. Playwright Patty Chayefsky. And from my own part of the country, Tom Lee, author and artist. He told me that on the back of the picture of the dun horse he had lent us were the words, "Dun horse with zebra legs. He will die before he gets tired." You can see that in the lift of his head. When he finished with the receiving line, Lyndon went back upstairs. He whispered to me he'd like to have a boat trip on the river. I said, "Fine, I'll get Barbara Jackson and her husband, who are our house guests, and you invite everybody else you want, and we'll go as soon as I've had a little time out on the lawn to visit with the Presidential Scholars and their parents and these distinguished guests, because, after all, Lucy Baines is the hostess for the supper buffet. But first, there was the reception in the state dining room, planned especially for the parents who will leave after it. A nice mingling, too, of all three elements. I had a chance to congratulate Charles Bolin, the son of the ambassador to France, and Barbara Pendleton of Georgia, a friend of Dr. Hurst. He'd written me about her. In fact, I had an especially warm hand clasp for all those Presidential Scholars from Mississippi and Alabama and Arkansas and Texas. Soon I felt it was a good party, in spite of awkward moments. I began to feel that glow that people were having a happy time. I was urging all the parents to please be at home, have a leisurely visit in the blue room, in the red room, in the green room. And then I asked Barbara if she and her husband wouldn't join us out on the lawn for a while. I knew it would be a thrill for the young people to meet her. I even got a large identification tag pinned on her. This I had learned from the last one we had had. Students failed to recognize Helen Hayes. So each distinguished guest was well marked with a large name tag so their lustrous presence wouldn't go unknown and uncelebrated. Lawn was gay with the red and white striped tents and lantern and the shell for entertainments and the fountain and the fading twilight sky. And each was soon gravitating to his kind, Dr. Salk proving one of the most delightful guest present and a regular lodestone for youngsters studying physics and chemistry. And many gathered around Senator Bill Fulbright, and Stan Musial brought out Lucy in her pretty white graduation dress on his arm. They were soon surrounded. And of course, modest but so very likable Colonel John Glenn had a crowd of youngsters around him. With some good newspaper people present, John Chancellor.